In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Chapter 13 of the Oregon Trail. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, Jr. Chapter 13, Hunting Indians. At last we had reached Labonte's camp, toward which our eyes had turned so long. Of all weary hours, those that passed between noon and sunset of the day when we arrived there may bear away the palm of exquisite discomfort. I lay under the tree, reflecting on what course to pursue, watching the shadows which seemed never to move, and the sun which remained fixed in the sky, and hoping every moment to see the men and horses of Bissonnette emerging from the woods. Shaw and Henry had ridden out on a scouting expedition, and did not return until the sun was setting. There was nothing very cheering in their faces, nor in the news they brought. "We have been 10 miles from here," said Shaw. "We climbed the highest butte we could find and could not see a buffalo or Indian. Nothing but prairie for 20 miles around us." Henry's horse was quite disabled by clambering up and down the sides of ravines, and Shaw's was severely fatigued. After supper that evening, as we sat around the fire, I proposed to Shaw to wait one day longer in hopes of Bissonnette's arrival, and if he should not come, to send Delorier with the cart and baggage back to Fort Laramie, while we ourselves followed the Whirlwind's village and attempted to overtake it as it passed the mountains. Shaw, not having the same motive for hunting Indians that I had, was averse to the plan. I, therefore, resolved to go alone. This design I adopted very unwillingly, for I knew that in the present state of my health the attempt would be extremely unpleasant, and, as I considered, hazardous. I hoped that Bissonnette would appear in the course of the following day and bring us some information by which to direct our course, and enable me to accomplish my purpose by means less objectionable. The rifle of Henry Chatillon was necessary for the subsistence of the party in my absence, so I called Raymond and ordered him to prepare to set out with me. Raymond rolled his eyes vacantly about, but at length, having succeeded in grappling with the idea, he withdrew to his bed under the cart. He was a heavy-moulded fellow, with a broad face exactly like an owl's, expressing the most impenetrable stupidity and entire self-confidence. As for his good qualities, he had a sort of stubborn fidelity, an insensibility to danger, and a kind of instinct or sagacity which sometimes led him right where better heads than his were at a loss. Besides this, he knew very well how to handle a rifle and picket a horse. Through the following day the sun glared down upon us with a pitiless, penetrating heat. The distant blue prairie seemed quivering under it. The lodge of our Indian associates was baking in the rays, and our rifles, as they leaned against the tree, were too hot for the touch. There was a dead silence through our camp and all around it, unbroken except by the hum of gnats and mosquitoes. The men, resting their foreheads on their arms, were sleeping under the cart. The Indians kept close within their lodge, except the newly married pair, who were seated together under an awning of buffalo robes, and the old conjurer, who, with his hard, emaciated face and gaunt ribs, was perched aloft like a turkey buzzard among the dead branches of an old tree, constantly on the lookout for enemies. He would have made a capital shot. A rifle bullet skillfully planted would have brought him tumbling to the ground. Surely, I thought, there could be no more harm in shooting such a hideous old villain, to see how ugly he would look when he was dead, than in shooting the detestable vulture which he resembled. We dined, and then Shaw saddled his horse. "I will ride back," said he, "to Horseshoe Creek, and see if Bissonnette is there." "I would go with you," I answered, "but I must reserve all the strength I have." The afternoon dragged away at last. I occupied myself in cleaning my rifle and pistols, and making other preparations for the journey. After supper, Henry Chatillon and I lay by the fire discussing the properties of that admirable weapon, the rifle, in the use of which he could fairly outrival Leatherstocking himself. It was late before I wrapped myself in my blanket and lay down for the night with my head on my saddle. Shaw had not returned, but this gave no uneasiness, for we presumed that he had fallen in with Bissonnette and was spending the night with him. For a day or two past I had gained in strength and health, but about midnight an attack of pain awoke me, and for some hours I felt no inclination to sleep. The moon was quivering on the broad breast of the Platte. Nothing could be heard except those low, inexplicable sounds like whisperings and footsteps, which no one who has spent the night alone amid deserts and forests will be at a loss to understand. As I was falling asleep, a familiar voice shouting from the distance awoke me again. A rapid step approached the camp, and Shaw, on foot, with his gun in his hand, hastily entered. "Where's your horse?" said I, raising myself on my elbow. "Lost," said Shaw. "Where's Delorier?" "There," I replied, pointing to a confused mass of blankets and buffalo robes. Shaw touched them with the butt of his gun, and up sprang our faithful Canadian. "Come, Delorier, stir up the fire and get me something to eat." "Where's Bissonnette?" asked I. "The Lord knows. There's nobody at Horseshoe Creek." Shaw had gone back to the spot where we had encamped 2 days before, and, finding nothing there but the ashes of our fires, he had tied his horse to the tree while he bathed in the stream. Something startled his horse, who broke loose, and for 2 hours Shaw tried in vain to catch him. Sunset approached, and it was 12 miles to camp. So he abandoned the attempt, and set out on foot to join us. The greater part of his perilous and solitary work was performed in darkness. His moccasins were worn to tatters, and his feet severely lacerated. He sat down to eat, however, with the usual equanimity of his temper, and not at all disturbed by his misfortune, and my last recollection before falling asleep was of Shaw seated cross-legged before the fire, smoking his pipe. The horse, I may as well mention here, was found the next morning by Henry Chatillon. When I awoke again, there was a fresh, damp smell in the air, a gray twilight involved the prairie, and above its eastern verge was a streak of cold red sky. I called to the men, and in a moment a fire was blazing brightly in the dim morning light, and breakfast was getting ready. We sat down together on the grass to the last civilized meal which Raymond and I were destined to enjoy for some time. "Now bring in the horses." My little mare Pauline was soon standing by the fire. She was a fleet, hardy, and gentle animal, christened after Paul Dorion, from whom I had procured her in exchange for Pontiac. She did not look as if equipped for a morning pleasure ride. In front of the black, high-bowed mountain saddle, holsters with heavy pistols were fastened. A pair of saddlebags, a blanket tightly rolled, a small parcel of Indian presents tied up in a buffalo skin, a leather bag of flour, and a smaller one of tea were all secured behind, and a long trail rope was wound round her neck. Raymond had a strong black mule equipped in a similar manner. We crammed our powder horns to the throat and mounted. "I will meet you at Fort Laramie on the 1st of August," said I to Shaw. "That is," replied he, "if we don't meet before that. I think I shall follow after you in a day or two." This, in fact, he attempted, and he would have succeeded if he had not encountered obstacles against which his resolute spirit was of no avail. 2 days after I left him, he sent Delorier to the fort with a cart and baggage, and set out for the mountains with Henry Chatillon. But a tremendous thunderstorm had deluged the prairie and nearly obliterated not only our trail, but that of the Indians themselves. They followed along the base of the mountains, at a loss in which direction to go. They encamped there, and in the morning Shaw found himself poisoned by ivy in such a manner that it was impossible for him to travel. So they turned back reluctantly toward Fort Laramie. Shaw's limbs were swollen to double their usual size, and he rode in great pain. They encamped again within 20 miles of the fort and reached it early on the following morning. Shaw lay seriously ill for a week, and remained at the fort till I rejoined him some time after. To return to my own story. We shook hands with our friends, rode out upon the prairie, and clambering the sandy hollows that were channeled in the sides of the hills, gained the high plains above. If a curse had been pronounced upon the land, it could not have worn an aspect of more dreary and forlorn barrenness. There were abrupt broken hills, deep hollows, and wide plains, but all alike glared with an insupportable whiteness under the burning sun. The country, as if parched by the heat, had cracked into innumerable fissures and ravines that not a little impeded our progress. Their steep sides were white and raw, and along the bottom we several times discovered the broad tracks of the terrific grizzly bear, nowhere more abundant than in this region. The ridges of the hills were hard as rock and strewn with pebbles of flint and coarse red jasper. Looking from them, there was nothing to relieve the desert uniformity of the prospect, save here and there a pine tree clinging at the edge of a ravine and stretching out its rough, shaggy arms. Under the scorching heat, these melancholy trees diffused their peculiar resinous odor through the sultry air. There was something in it as I approached them that recalled old associations. The pine-clad mountains of New England, traversed in days of health and buoyancy, rose like a reality before my fancy. In passing that arid waste, I was goaded with a morbid thirst produced by my disorder, and I thought with a longing desire on the crystal treasure poured in such wasteful profusion from our thousand hills. Shutting my eyes, I more than half believed that I heard the deep plunging and gurgling of waters in the bowels of the shaded rocks. I could see their dark ice glittering far down amid the crevices, and the cold drops trickling from the long green mosses. When noon came, we found a little stream with a few trees and bushes, and here we rested for an hour. Then we traveled on, guided by the sun, until just before sunset we reached another stream called Bitter Cottonwood Creek. A thick growth of bushes and old storm-beaten trees grew at intervals along its bank. Near the foot of one of the trees we flung down our saddles, and hobbling our horses, turned them loose to feed. The little stream was clear and swift, and ran musically on its white sands. Small water birds were splashing in the shallows and filling the air with their cries and flutterings. The sun was just sinking among gold and crimson clouds behind Mount Laramie. I well remember how I lay upon a log by the margin of the water and watched the restless motions of the little fish in a deep, still nook below. Strange to say, I seemed to have gained strength since the morning, and almost felt a sense of returning health. We built our fire. Night came, and the wolves began to howl. One deep voice commenced, and it was answered in awful responses from the hills, the plains, and the woods along the stream above and below us. Such sounds need not and do not disturb one's sleep upon the prairie. We picketed the mare and the mule close at our feet and did not wake until daylight. Then we turned them loose, still hobbled, to feed for an hour before starting. We were getting ready our morning's meal when Raymond saw an antelope at half a mile's distance and said he would go and shoot it. "Your business," said I, "is to look after the animals. I am too weak to do much if anything happens to them, and you must keep within sight of the camp." Raymond promised and set out with his rifle in his hand. The animals had passed across the stream and were feeding among the long grass on the other side, much tormented by the attacks of the numerous large green-headed flies. As I watched them, I saw them go down into a hollow, and as several minutes elapsed without their reappearing, I waded through the stream to look after them. To my vexation and alarm, I discovered them at a great distance, galloping away at full speed, Pauline in advance with her hobbles broken, and the mule, still fettered, following with awkward leaps. I fired my rifle and shouted to recall Raymond. In a moment he came running through the stream with a red handkerchief bound round his head. I pointed to the fugitives and ordered him to pursue them. Muttering a "sach" between his teeth, he set out at full speed, still swinging his rifle in his hand. I walked up to the top of a hill, and looking away over the prairie, could just distinguish the runaways still at full gallop. Returning to the fire, I sat down at the foot of a tree. Wearily and anxiously, hour after hour passed away. The old loose bark dangling from the trunk behind me flapped to and fro in the wind, and the mosquitoes kept up their incessant drowsy humming. but other than this there was no sight nor sound of life throughout the burning landscape. The sun rose higher and higher, until the shadows fell almost perpendicularly, and I knew that it must be noon. It seemed scarcely possible that the animals could be recovered. If they were not, my situation was one of serious difficulty. Shaw, when I left him, had decided to move that morning, but whither he had not determined. To look for him would be a vain attempt. Fort Laramie was 40 miles distant, and I could not walk a mile without great effort. Not then having learned the sound philosophy of yielding to disproportionate obstacles, I resolved to continue in any event the pursuit of the Indians. Only one plan occurred to me. This was to send Raymond to the fort with an order for more horses, while I remained on the spot awaiting his return, which might take place within 3 days. But the adoption of this resolution did not wholly allay my anxiety, for it involved both uncertainty and danger. To remain stationary and alone for 3 days in a country full of dangerous Indians was not the most flattering of prospects, and protracted as my Indian hunt must be by such delay, it was not easy to foretell its ultimate result. Revolving these matters, I grew hungry, and as our stock of provisions, except 4 or 5 pounds of flour, was by this time exhausted, I left the camp to see what game I could find. Nothing could be seen except 4 or 5 large curlew, which, with their loud screaming, were wheeling over my head, and now and then alighting upon the prairie. I shot 2 of them, and was about returning, when a startling sight caught my eye. A small dark object, like a human head, suddenly appeared, and vanished, among the thick bushes along the stream below. In that country every stranger is a suspected enemy. Instinctively I threw forward the muzzle of my rifle. In a moment the bushes were violently shaken. 2 heads, but not human heads, protruded, and to my great joy I recognized the downcast, disconsolate countenance of the black mule and the yellow visage of Pauline. Raymond came upon the mule, pale and haggard, complaining of a fiery pain in his chest. I took charge of the animals while he kneeled down by the side of the stream to drink. He had kept the runaways in sight as far as the side fork of Laramie Creek, a distance of more than 10 miles, and here, with great difficulty, he had succeeded in catching them. I saw that he was unarmed, and asked him what he had done with his rifle. It had encumbered him in his pursuit, and he had dropped it on the prairie, thinking that he could find it on his return, but in this he had failed. The loss might prove a very formidable one. I was too much rejoiced, however, at the recovery of the animals to think much about it, and having made some tea for Raymond in a tin vessel which we had brought with us, I told him that I would give him 2 hours for resting before we set out again. He had eaten nothing that day, but having no appetite, he lay down immediately to sleep. I picketed the animals among the richest grass that I could find, and made fires of green wood to protect them from the flies. Then, sitting down again by the tree, I watched the slow movements of the sun, begrudging every moment that passed. The time I had mentioned expired, and I awoke Raymond. We saddled and set out again, but first we went in search of the lost rifle, and in the course of an hour Raymond was fortunate enough to find it. Then we turned westward and moved over the hills and hollows at a slow pace toward the Black Hills. The heat no longer tormented us, for a cloud was before the sun. Yet that day shall never be marked with white in my calendar. The air began to grow fresh and cool. The distant mountains frowned more gloomily. There was a low muttering of thunder, and dense black masses of cloud rose heavily behind the broken peaks. At first they were gaily fringed with silver by the afternoon sun, but soon the thick blackness overspread the whole sky, and the desert around us was wrapped in deep gloom. I scarcely heeded it at the time, but now I cannot but feel that there was an awful sublimity in the hoarse murmuring of the thunder, in the somber shadows that involved the mountains and the plain. The storm broke. It came upon us with a zigzag blinding flash, with a terrific crash of thunder, and with a hurricane that howled over the prairie, dashing floods of water against us. Raymond looked round and cursed the merciless elements. There seemed no shelter near, but we discerned at length a deep ravine gashed in the level prairie, and saw halfway down its side an old pine tree whose rough horizontal boughs formed a sort of penthouse against the tempest. We found a practicable passage, and hastily descending, fastened our animals to some large loose stones at the bottom. Then climbing up, we drew our blankets over our heads and seated ourselves close beneath the old tree. Perhaps I was no competent judge of time, but it seemed to me that we were sitting there a full hour, while around us poured a deluge of rain through which the rocks on the opposite side of the gulf were barely visible. The first burst of the tempest soon subsided, but the rain poured steadily. At length Raymond grew impatient, and scrambling out of the ravine, he gained the level prairie above. "What does the weather look like?" asked I, from my seat under the tree. "It looks bad," he answered. "Dark all around." And again he descended and sat down by my side. Some 10 minutes elapsed. "Go up again," said I, "and take another look." And he clambered up the precipice. "Well, how is it?" "Just the same. Only I see one little bright spot over the top of the mountain." The rain by this time had begun to abate, and going down to the bottom of the ravine, we loosened the animals who were standing up to their knees in water. Leading them up the rocky throat of the ravine, we reached the plain above. "Am I thought to myself, "the same man who, a few months since, was seated, a quiet student of belles lettres, in a cushioned armchair by a sea-coal fire?" All around us was obscurity, but the bright spot above the mountain tops grew wider and ruddier, until at length the clouds drew apart, and a flood of sunbeams poured down from heaven, streaming along the precipices and involving them in a thin blue haze, as soft and lovely as that which wraps the Apennines on an evening in spring. Rapidly the clouds were broken and scattered, like routed legions of evil spirits. The plain lay basking in sunbeams around us. A rainbow arched the desert from north to south, and far in front a line of woods seemed inviting us to refreshment and repose. When we reached them, they were glistening with prismatic dewdrops and enlivened by the song and flutterings of 100 birds. Strange winged insects, benumbed by the rain, were clinging to the leaves and bark of the trees. Raymond kindled a fire with great difficulty. The animals turned eagerly to feed on the soft, rich grass, while I, wrapping myself in my blanket, lay down and gazed on the evening landscape. The mountains, whose stern features had lowered upon us with so gloomy and awful a frown, now seemed lighted up with a serene, benignant smile, and the green waving undulations of the plain were gladdened with the rich sunshine. Wet, ill, and wearied as I was, my spirit grew lighter at the view, and I drew from it an augury of good for my future prospects. When morning came, Raymond awoke, coughing violently, though I had apparently received no injury. We mounted, crossed the little stream, pushed through the trees, and began our journey over the plain beyond. And now, as we rode slowly along, we looked anxiously on every hand for traces of the Indians, not doubting that the village had passed somewhere in that vicinity. But the scanty shriveled grass was not more than 3 or 4 inches high, and the ground was of such unyielding hardness that a host might have marched over it and left scarcely a trace of its passage. Uphill and downhill and clambering through ravines, we continued our journey. As we were skirting the foot of a hill, I saw Raymond, who was some rods in advance, suddenly jerking the reins of his mule. Sliding from his seat and running in a crouching posture up a hollow, he disappeared, and then in an instant I heard the sharp, quick crack of his rifle. A wounded antelope came running on 3 legs over the hill. I lashed Pauline and made after him. My fleet little mare soon brought me by his side, and after leaping and bounding for a few moments in vain, he stood still, as if despairing of escape. His glistening eyes turned up toward my face with so piteous a look that it was with feelings of infinite compunction that I shot him through the head with a pistol. Raymond skinned and cut him up, and we hung the forequarters to our saddles, much rejoiced that our exhausted stock of provisions was renewed in such good time. Gaining the top of a hill, we could see along the cloudy verge of the prairie before us lines of trees and shadowy groves that marked the course of Laramie Creek. Some time before noon we reached its banks and began anxiously to search them for footprints of the Indians. We followed the stream for several miles, now on the shore and now wading in the water, scrutinizing every sandbar and every muddy bank. So long was the search that we began to fear that we had left the trail undiscovered behind us. At length I heard Raymond shouting and saw him jump from his mule to examine some object under the shelving bank. I rode up to his side. It was the clear and palpable impression of an Indian moccasin. Encouraged by this, we continued our search, and at last some appearances on a soft surface of earth not far from the shore attracted my eye. And going to examine them, I found half a dozen tracks, some made by men and some by children. Just then, Raymond observed across the stream the mouth of a small branch entering it from the south. He forded the water, rode in at the opening, and in a moment I heard him shouting again, so I passed over and joined him. The little branch had a broad sandy bed, along which the water trickled in a scanty stream, and on either bank the bushes were so close that the view was completely intercepted. I found Raymond stooping over the footprints of three or four horses. Proceeding, we found those of a man, then those of a child, then those of more horses, and at last the bushes on each bank were beaten down and broken, and the sand plowed up with a multitude of footsteps and scored across with the furrows made by the lodge poles that had been dragged through. It was now certain that we had found the trail. I pushed through the bushes, and at a little distance on the prairie beyond found the ashes of 150 lodge fires with bones and pieces of buffalo robes scattered around them, and in some instances the pickets to which horses had been secured still standing in the ground. Elated by our success, we selected a convenient tree, and turning the animals loose, prepared to make a meal from the fat haunch of our victim. Hardship and exposure had thriven with me wonderfully. I had gained both health and strength since leaving Labonte's camp. Raymond and I made a hearty meal together in high spirits, for we rashly presumed that having found one end of the trail, we should have little difficulty in reaching the other. But when the animals were led in, we found that our old ill luck had not ceased to follow us close. As I was saddling Pauline, I saw that her eye was as dull as lead, and the hue of her yellow coat visibly darkened. I placed my foot in the stirrup to mount, when instantly she staggered and fell flat on her side. Gaining her feet with an effort, she stood by the fire with a drooping head. Whether she had been bitten by a snake, or poisoned by some noxious plant, or attacked by a sudden disorder, it was hard to say. But at all events her sickness was sufficiently ill-timed and unfortunate. I succeeded in a second attempt to mount her, and with a slow pace we moved forward on the trail of the Indians. It led us up a hill and over a dreary plain, and here, to our great mortification, the traces almost disappeared, for the ground was as hard as adamant, and if its flinty surface had ever retained the print of a hoof, the marks had been washed away by the deluge of yesterday. An Indian village, in its disorderly march, is scattered over the prairie, often to the width of a full half a mile, so that its trail is nowhere clearly marked, and the task of following it is made doubly wearisome and difficult. By good fortune, plenty of large anthills, a yard or more in diameter, were scattered over the plain, and these were frequently broken by the footprints of men and horses, and marked by traces of the lodge poles. The succulent leaves of the prickly pear, also bruised from the same causes, helped a little to guide us, so inch by inch we moved along. Often we lost the trail altogether, and then would recover it again. But late in the afternoon we found ourselves totally at fault. We stood alone, without clue to guide us. The broken plain expanded for league after league around us, and in front the long dark ridge of mountains was stretching from north to south. Mount Laramie, a little on our right, towered high above the rest, and from a dark valley just beyond one of its lower declivities we discerned volumes of white smoke slowly rolling up into the clear air. "I think," said Raymond, "some Indians must be there. Perhaps we had better go." But this plan was not rashly to be adopted, and we determined still to continue our search after the lost trail. Our good stars prompted us to this decision, for we afterward had reason to believe, from information given us by the Indians, that the smoke was raised as a decoy by a Crow war party. Evening was coming on, and there was no wood or water nearer than the foot of the mountains. So thither we turned, directing our course toward the point where Laramie Creek issues forth upon the prairie. When we reached it, the bare tops of the mountains were still brightened with sunshine. The little river was breaking with a vehement and angry current from its dark prison. There was something in the near vicinity of the mountains, in the loud surging of the rapids, wonderfully cheering and exhilarating, for although once as familiar as home itself, they had been for months strangers to my experience. There was a rich grass plot by the river's bank, surrounded by low ridges, which would effectually screen ourselves and our fire from the sight of wandering Indians. Here among the grass I observed numerous circles of large stones, which, as Raymond said, were traces of a Dakota winter encampment. We lay down and did not awake till the sun was up. A large rock projected from the shore, and behind it the deep water was slowly eddying round and round. The temptation was irresistible. I threw off my clothes, leaped in, and suffered myself to be borne once round with the current, and then, seizing the strong root of a water plant, drew myself to the shore. The effect was so invigorating and refreshing that I mistook it for returning health. Pauline, thought I, as I led the little mare up to be saddled, only thrive as I do, and you and I will have sport yet among the buffalo beyond these mountains. But scarcely were we mounted and on our way before the momentary glow passed. Again I hung as usual in my seat, scarcely able to hold myself erect. "Look yonder," said Raymond. "You see that big hollow there? The Indians must have gone that way if they went anywhere about here." We reached the gap, which was like a deep notch cut into the mountain ridge, and here we soon discerned an anthill furrowed with the mark of a lodgepole. This was quite enough, there could be no doubt now. As we rode on, the opening growing narrower, the Indians had been compelled to march in closer order, and the traces became numerous and distinct. The gap terminated in a rocky gateway leading into a rough passage upward between two precipitous mountains. Here grass and weeds were bruised to fragments by the throng that had passed through. We moved slowly over the rocks, up the passage, and in this toilsome manner we advanced for an hour or two, bare precipices hundreds of feet high shooting up on either hand. Raymond, with his hardy mule, was a few rods before me when we came to the foot of an ascent steeper than the rest, and which I trusted might prove the highest point of the defile. Pauline strained upward for a few yards, moaning and stumbling, and then came to a dead stop, unable to proceed further. I dismounted and attempted to lead her, but my own exhausted strength soon gave out, so I loosened the trail rope from her neck, and tying it round my arm, crawled up on my hands and knees. I gained the top, totally exhausted, the sweat drops trickling from my forehead. Pauline stood like a statue by my side, her shadow falling upon the scorching rock, and in this shade, for there was no other, I lay for some time, scarcely able to move a limb. All around, the black crags, sharp as needles at the top, stood glowing in the sun, without a tree or a bush or a blade of grass to cover their precipitous sides. The whole scene seemed parched with a pitiless, insufferable heat. After a while I could mount again, and we moved on, descending the rocky defile on its western side. Thinking of that morning's journey, it has sometimes seemed to me that there was something ridiculous in my position. A man armed to the teeth, but wholly unable to fight, and equally so to run away, traversing a dangerous wilderness on a sick horse. But these thoughts were retrospective, for at the time I was in too grave a mood to entertain a very lively sense of the ludicrous. Raymond's saddle girth slipped, and while I proceeded he was stopping behind to repair the mischief. I came to the top of a little declivity where a most welcome sight greeted my eye. A nook of fresh green grass nestled among the cliffs, sunny clumps of bushes on one side, and shaggy old pine trees leaning forward from the rocks on the other. A shrill, familiar voice saluted me and recalled me to days of boyhood, that of the insect called the locust by New England schoolboys, which was fast clinging among the heated boughs of the old pine trees. Then, too, as I passed the bushes, the low sound of falling water reached my ear. Pauline turned of her own accord, and pushing through the boughs we found a black rock overarched by the cool green canopy. An icy stream was pouring from its side into a wide basin of white sand, from whence it had no visible outlet, but filtered through into the soil below. While I filled a tin cup at the spring, Pauline was eagerly plunging her head deep in the pool. Other visitors had been there before us. All around in the soft soil were the footprints of elk, deer, and the Rocky Mountain sheep, and the grizzly bear, too, had left the recent prints of his broad foot with its frightful array of claws. Among these mountains was his home. Soon after leaving the spring, we found a little grassy plain encircled by the mountains, and marked to our great joy with all the traces of an Indian camp. Raymond's practiced eye detected certain signs by which he recognized the spot where Reynal's lodge had been pitched and his horses picketed. I approached and stood looking at the place. Reynal and I had, I believe, hardly a feeling in common. I disliked the fellow, and it perplexed me a good deal to understand why I should look with so much interest on the ashes of his fire, when between him and me there seemed no other bond of sympathy than the slender and precarious one of a kindred race. In half an hour from this we were clear of the mountains. There was a plain before us, totally barren and thickly peopled in many parts with the little prairie dogs, who sat at the mouths of their burrows and yelped at us as we passed. The plain, as we thought, was about 6 miles wide, but it cost us 2 hours to cross it. Then another mountain range rose before us, grander and more wild than the last had been. Far out of the dense shrubbery that clothed the steeps for 1,000 feet shot up black crags, all leaning one way, and shattered by storms and thunder into grim and threatening shapes. As we entered a narrow passage on the trail of the Indians, they impended frightfully on one side above our heads. Our course was through dense woods in the shade and twinkling sunlight of overhanging boughs. I would I could recall to mind all the startling combinations that presented themselves, as, winding from side to side of the passage to avoid its obstructions, we could see, glancing at intervals through the foliage, the awful forms of the gigantic cliffs that seemed at times to hem us in on the right and on the left, before us and behind. Another scene in a few moments greeted us, a tract of gray and sunny woods, broken into knolls and hollows, enlivened by birds and interspersed with flowers. Among the rest I recognized the mellow whistle of the robin, an old familiar friend whom I had scarce expected to meet in such a place. Humblebees, too, were buzzing heavily about the flowers, and of these a species of larkspur caught my eye, more appropriate, it should seem, to cultivated gardens than to a remote wilderness. Instantly it recalled a multitude of dormant and delightful recollections. Leaving behind us this spot and its associations, a sight soon presented itself characteristic of that warlike region. In an open space, fenced in by high rocks, stood 2 Indian forts of a square form, rudely built of sticks and logs. They were somewhat ruinous, having probably been constructed the year before. Each might have contained about 20 men. Perhaps in this gloomy spot some party had been beset by their enemies, and those scowling rocks and blasted trees might not long since have looked down on a conflict unchronicled and unknown. Yet if any traces of bloodshed remained, they were completely hidden by the bushes and tall rank weeds. Gradually the mountains drew apart, and the passage expanded into a plain, where again we found traces of an Indian encampment. There were trees and bushes just before us, and we stopped here for an hour's rest and refreshment. When we had finished our meal, Raymond struck fire, and, lighting his pipe, sat down at the foot of a tree to smoke. For some time I observed him puffing away with a face of unusual solemnity. Then, slowly taking the pipe from his lips, he looked up and remarked that we had better not go any farther. "Why not?" asked I. He said that the country was becoming very dangerous, and that we were entering the range of the Snakes, Arapahoes, and Gros Ventre Blackfeet, and that if any of their wandering parties should meet us, it would cost us our lives. But, he added, with a blunt fidelity that nearly reconciled me to his stupidity, that he would go anywhere I wished. I told him to bring up the animals, and mounting them we proceeded again. I confess that, as we moved forward, the prospect seemed but a dreary and doubtful one. I would have given the world for my ordinary elasticity of body and mind, and for a horse of such strength and spirit as the journey required. Closer and closer the rocks gathered round us, growing taller and steeper, and pressing more and more upon our path. We entered at length a defile which I never had seen rivaled. The mountain was cracked from top to bottom, and we were creeping along the bottom of the fissure in dampness and gloom, with the clink of hoofs on the loose shingly rocks, and the hoarse murmuring of a petulant brook which kept us company. Sometimes the water, foaming among the stones, overspread the whole narrow passage. Sometimes, withdrawing to one side, it gave us room to pass dry-shod. Looking up, we could see a narrow ribbon of bright blue sky between the dark edges of the opposing cliffs. This did not last long. The passage soon widened, and sunbeams found their way down, flashing upon the black waters. The defile would spread out to many rods in width. Bushes, trees, and flowers would spring by the side of the brook. The cliffs would be feathered with shrubbery that clung in every crevice, and fringed with trees that grew along their sunny edges. Then we would be moving again in the darkness. The passage seemed about 4 miles long, and before we reached the end of it, the unshod hoofs of our animals were lamentably broken, and their legs cut by the sharp stones. Issuing from the mountain, we found another plain. All around it stood a circle of lofty precipices that seemed the impersonation of silence and solitude. Here again the Indians had encamped, as well they might, after passing with their women, children, and horses through the gulf behind us. In one day we had made a journey which had cost them 3 to accomplish. The only outlet to this amphitheater lay over a hill some 200 feet high, up which we moved with difficulty. Looking from the top, we saw that at last we were free of the mountains. The prairie spread before us, but so wild and broken that the view was everywhere obstructed. Far on our left, one tall hill swelled up against the sky, on the smooth pale green surface of which 4 slowly moving black specks were discernible. They were evidently buffalo, and we hailed the sight as a good augury, for where the buffalo were, there too the Indians would probably be found. We hoped on that very night to reach the village. We were anxious to do so for a double reason, wishing to bring our wearisome journey to an end, and knowing, moreover, that though to enter the village in broad daylight would be a perfectly safe experiment, yet to encamp in its vicinity would be dangerous. But as we rode on, the sun was sinking, and soon was within 30 minutes of the horizon. We ascended a hill and looked round us for a spot for our encampment. The prairie was like a turbulent ocean, suddenly congealed when its waves were at the highest, and it lay half in light and half in shadow, as the rich sunshine, yellow as gold, was pouring over it. The rough bushes of the wild sage were growing everywhere, its dull pale green overspreading hill and hollow. Yet a little way before us, a bright verdant line of grass was winding along the plain, and here and there throughout its course water was glistening darkly. We went down to it, kindled a fire, and turned our horses loose to feed. It was a little trickling brook that for some yards on either bank turned the barren prairie into fertility, and here and there it spread into deep pools where the beaver had dammed it up. We placed our last remaining piece of the antelope before a scanty fire, mournfully reflecting on our exhausted stock of provisions. Just then, an enormous gray hare, peculiar to these prairies, came jumping along and seated himself within 50 yards to look at us. I thoughtlessly raised my rifle to shoot him, but Raymond called out to me not to fire, for fear the report should reach the ears of the Indians. That night, for the first time, we considered that the danger to which we were exposed was of a somewhat serious character. And to those who are unacquainted with Indians, it may seem strange that our chief apprehensions arose from the supposed proximity of the people whom we intended to visit. Had any straggling party of these faithful friends caught sight of us from the hilltop, they would probably have returned in the night to plunder us of our horses and perhaps of our scalps. But we were on the prairie, where the genius loci is at war with all nervous apprehensions, and I presume that neither Raymond nor I thought twice of the matter that evening. While he was looking after the animals, I sat by the fire engaged in the novel task of baking bread. The utensils were the most simple and primitive kind, consisting of two sticks inclining over the bed of coals, one end thrust into the ground while the dough was twisted in a spiral form round the other. Under such circumstances, all the Epicurean in a man's nature is apt to awaken within him. I revisited in fancy the far-distant abodes of good fare. Not indeed Frascati's, or the Trois Frères Provençaux, for that were too extreme a flight, but no other than the homely table of my old friend and host, Tom Crawford of the White Mountains. By a singular revulsion, Tom himself, whom I well remember to have looked upon as the impersonation of all that is wild and backwoodsmanlike, now appeared before me as the ministering angel of comfort and good living. Being fatigued and drowsy, I began to doze, and my thoughts, following the same train of association, assumed another form. Half dreaming, I saw myself surrounded with the mountains of New England, alive with waterfalls, their black crags tinctured with milk-white mists. For this reverie I paid a speedy penalty, for the bread was black on one side and soft on the other. For 8 hours, Raymond and I, pillowed on our saddles, lay insensible as logs. Pauline's yellow head was stretched over me when I awoke. I got up and examined her. Her feet indeed were bruised and swollen by the accidents of yesterday, but her eye was brighter, her motions livelier, and her mysterious malady had visibly abated. We moved on, hoping within an hour to come in sight of the Indian village, but again disappointment awaited us. The trail disappeared, melting away upon a hard and stony plain. Raymond and I, separating, rode from side to side, scrutinizing every yard of ground, until at length I discerned traces of the lodge-poles passing by the side of a ridge of rocks. We began again to follow them. "What is that black spot out there on the prairie?"
"It looks like a dead buffalo," answered Raymond.
We rode out to it, and found it to be the huge carcass of a bull killed by the Indians as they had passed. Tangled hair and scraps of hide were scattered all around, for the wolves had been making merry over it, and had hollowed out the entire carcass. It was covered with myriads of large black crickets, and from its appearance must certainly have lain there for 4 or 5 days. The sight was a most disheartening one, and I observed to Raymond that the Indians might still be 50 or 60 miles before us. But he shook his head, and replied that they dared not go so far for fear of their enemies, the snakes. Soon after this we lost the trail again, and ascended a neighboring ridge totally at a loss. Before us lay a plain perfectly flat, spreading on the right and left without apparent limit, and bounded in front by a long broken line of hills 10 or 12 miles distant. All was open and exposed to view, yet not a buffalo nor an Indian was visible.
"Do you see that?" said Raymond. "Now we had better turn round."
But as Raymond's bourgeois thought otherwise, we descended the hill and began to cross the plain. We had come so far that I knew perfectly well neither Pauline's limbs nor my own could carry me back to Fort Laramie. I considered that the lines of expediency and inclination tallied exactly, and that the most prudent course was to keep forward. The ground immediately around us was thickly strewn with the skulls and bones of buffalo, for here, a year or two before, the Indians had made a surround. Yet no living game presented itself. At length, however, an antelope sprang up and gazed at us. We fired together, and by a singular fatality we both missed, although the animal stood a fair mark within 80 yards. This ill success might perhaps be charged to our own eagerness, for by this time we had no provision left except a little flour. We could discern several small lakes, or rather extensive pools of water, glistening in the distance. As we approached them,
Wolves and antelopes bounded away through the tall grass that grew in their vicinity, and flocks of large white plover flew screaming over their surface. Having failed of the antelope, Raymond tried his hand at the birds with the same ill success. The water also disappointed us. Its muddy margin was so beaten up by the crowd of buffalo that our timorous animals were afraid to approach. So we turned away and moved toward the hills. The rank grass, where it was not trampled down by the buffalo, fairly swept our horses' necks. Again we found the same execrable barren prairie offering no clue by which to guide our way. As we drew near the hills, an opening appeared, through which the Indians must have gone if they had passed that way at all. Slowly we began to ascend it. I felt the most dreary forebodings of ill success when, on looking round, I could discover neither dent of hoof nor footprint nor trace of lodgepole, though the passage was encumbered by the ghastly skulls of buffalo. We heard thunder muttering. A storm was coming on. As we gained the top of the gap, the prospect beyond began to disclose itself. First we saw a long dark line of ragged clouds upon the horizon, while above them rose the peak of the Medicine Bow, the vanguard of the Rocky Mountains. Then, little by little, the plain came into view, a vast green uniformity, forlorn and tenantless, though Laramie Creek glistened in a waving line over its surface, without a bush or tree upon its banks. As yet, the round projecting shoulder of a hill intercepted a part of the view. I rode in advance, when suddenly I could distinguish a few dark spots on the prairie along the bank of the stream. "Buffalo," said I. Then a sudden hope flashed upon me, and eagerly and anxiously I looked again. "Horses!" exclaimed Raymond, with a tremendous oath, lashing his mule forward as he spoke. More and more the plain disclosed itself, and in rapid succession more and more horses appeared, scattered along the river bank or feeding in bands over the prairie. Then suddenly, standing in a circle by the stream, swarming with their savage inhabitants, we saw rising before us the tall lodges of the Ogallala. Never did the heart of wanderer more gladden at the sight of home than did mine at the sight of those wild habitations. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of the Oregon Trail. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, Jr. Chapter 14. The Ogallala Village. Such a narrative as this is hardly the place for portraying the mental features of the Indians. The same picture, slightly changed in shade and coloring, would serve with very few exceptions for all the tribes that lie north of the Mexican territories. But with this striking similarity in their modes of thought, the tribes of the lake and ocean shores, of the forests and of the plains, differ greatly in their manner of life. Having been domesticated for several weeks among one of the wildest of the wild hordes that roam over the remote prairies, I had extraordinary opportunities of observing them, and I flatter myself that a faithful picture of the scenes that pass daily before my eyes may not be devoid of interest and value. These men were thorough savages. Neither their manners nor their ideas were in the slightest degree modified by contact with civilization. They knew nothing of the power and real character of the white men, and their children would scream in terror at the sight of me. Their religion, their superstitions, and their prejudices were the same that had been handed down to them from immemorial time. They fought with the same weapons that their fathers fought with, and wore the same rude garments of skins. Great changes are at hand in that region. With the stream of emigration to Oregon and California, the buffalo will dwindle away, and the large wandering communities who depend on them for support must be broken and scattered. The Indians will soon be corrupted by the example of the whites, abased by whiskey, and overawed by military posts, so that within a few years the traveler may pass in tolerable security through their country. Its danger and its charm will have disappeared together. As soon as Raymond and I discovered the village from the gap in the hills, we were seen in our turn. Keen eyes were constantly on the watch. As we rode down upon the plain, the side of the village nearest us was darkened with a crowd of naked figures gathering around the lodges. Several men came forward to meet us. I could distinguish among them the green blanket of the Frenchman Reynaud. When we came up, the ceremony of shaking hands had to be gone through with in due form, and then all were eager to know what had become of the rest of my party. I satisfied them on this point, and we all moved forward together toward the village.
"You've missed it," said Reynaud. "If you'd been here day before yesterday, you'd have found the whole prairie over yonder black with buffalo as far as you could see. There were no cows, though, nothing but bulls. We made a surround every day till yesterday. See the village there. Don't that look like good living?"
In fact, I could see, even at that distance, that long cords were stretched from lodge to lodge, over which the meat, cut by the squaws into thin sheets, was hanging to dry in the sun. I noticed, too, that the village was somewhat smaller than when I had last seen it, and I asked Reynaud the cause. He said that old Le Borgne had felt too weak to pass over the mountains, and so had remained behind with all his relations, including Mato Tatanka and his brothers. The Whirlwind, too, had been unwilling to come so far, because, as Reynaud said, he was afraid. Only half a dozen lodges had adhered to him, the main body of the village setting their chief's authority at naught, and taking the course most agreeable to their inclinations.
"What chiefs are there in the village now?" said I.
"Well," said Reynaud, "there's old Redwater, and the Eagle Feather, and the Big Crow, and the Mad Wolf, and the Panther, and the White Shield, and what's his name? The half-breed Cheyenne." By this time we were close to the village, and I observed that while the greater part of the lodges were very large and neat in their appearance, there was at one side a cluster of squalid, miserable huts. I looked toward them and made some remark about their wretched appearance, but I was touching upon delicate ground.
"My squaw's relations live in those lodges," said Reynaud very warmly, "and there isn't a better set in the whole village."
"Are there any chiefs among them?" asked I.
"Chiefs," said Reynaud, "yes, plenty."
"What are their names?" I inquired.
"Their names? Why, there's the Arrowhead. If he isn't a chief, he ought to be one. And there's the Hailstorm. He's nothing but a boy, to be sure, but he's bound to be a chief one of these days."
Just then we passed between two of the lodges and entered the great area of the village. Superb naked figures stood silently gazing on us.
"Where's the Bad Wounds Lodge?" said I to Reynaud.
"There, you've missed it again. The Bad Wound is away with the Whirlwind. If you could have found him here and gone to live in his lodge, he would have treated you better than any man in the village. But there's the Big Crow's Lodge yonder, next to old Redwater's. He's a good Indian for the whites, and I advise you to go and live with him."
"Are there many squaws and children in his lodge?" said I.
"No, only one squaw and two or three children. He keeps the rest in a separate lodge by themselves."
So, still followed by a crowd of Indians, Raymond and I rode up to the entrance of the Big Crow's lodge. A squaw came out immediately and took our horses. I put aside the leather nap that covered the low opening, and stooping, entered the Big Crow's dwelling. There I could see the chief in the dim light, seated at one side on a pile of buffalo robes. He greeted me with a guttural,
"How, Kola?"
I requested Reynaud to tell him that Raymond and I were come to live with him. The Big Crow gave another low exclamation. If the reader thinks that we were intruding somewhat cavalierly, I beg him to observe that every Indian in the village would have deemed himself honored that white men should give such preference to his hospitality. The squaw spread a buffalo robe for us in the guest's place at the head of the lodge. Our saddles were brought in, and scarcely were we seated upon them before the place was thronged with Indians, who came crowding in to see us. The Big Crow produced his pipe and filled it with a mixture of tobacco and shongsasha, or red willow bark. Round and round it passed, and a lively conversation went forward. Meanwhile, a squaw placed before the two guests a wooden bowl of boiled buffalo meat, but unhappily this was not the only banquet destined to be inflicted on us. Rapidly, one after another, boys and young squaws thrust their heads in at the opening to invite us to various feasts in different parts of the village. For half an hour or more we were actively engaged in passing from lodge to lodge, tasting in each of the bowl of meat set before us, and inhaling a whiff or two from our entertainer's pipe.
A thunderstorm that had been threatening for some time now began in good earnest. We crossed over to Reynal's lodge, though it hardly deserved this name, for it consisted only of a few old buffalo robes supported on poles, and was quite open on one side. Here we sat down, and the Indians gathered round us.
"What is it," said I, "that makes the thunder?"
"It's my belief," said Reynal, "that it is a big stone rolling over the sky."
"Very likely," I replied, "but I want to know what the Indians think about it."
So he interpreted my question, which seemed to produce some doubt and debate. There was evidently a difference of opinion. At last old Mene Sila, or Redwater, who sat by himself at one side, looked up with his withered face, and said he had always known what the thunder was. It was a great black bird, and once he had seen it in a dream, swooping down from the black hills with its loud roaring wings, and when it flapped them over a lake, they struck lightning from the water.
"The thunder is bad," said another old man, who sat muffled in his buffalo robe. "He killed my brother last summer."
Reynal, at my request, asked for an explanation, but the old man remained doggedly silent and would not look up. Some time after, I learned how the accident occurred. The man who was killed belonged to an association which, among other mystic functions, claimed the exclusive power and privilege of fighting the thunder. Whenever a storm which they wished to avert was threatening, the thunder fighters would take their bows and arrows, their guns, their magic drum, and a sort of whistle made out of the wing bone of the war eagle. Thus equipped, they would run out and fire at the rising cloud, whooping, yelling, whistling, and beating their drum, to frighten it down again. One afternoon a heavy black cloud was coming up, and they repaired to the top of a hill, where they brought all their magic artillery into play against it. But the undaunted thunder, refusing to be terrified, kept moving straight onward, and darted out a bright flash which struck one of the party dead, as he was in the very act of shaking his long iron-pointed lance against it. The rest scattered and ran, yelling in an ecstasy of superstitious terror, back to their lodges. The lodge of my host Kongra Tonga, or the Big Crow, presented a picturesque spectacle that evening. A score or more of Indians were seated around in a circle, their dark, naked forms just visible by the dull light of the smoldering fire in the center, the pipe glowing brightly in the gloom as it passed from hand to hand round the lodge. Then a squaw would drop a piece of buffalo fat on the dull embers. Instantly a bright, glancing flame would leap up, darting its clear light to the very apex of the tall conical structure, where the tops of the slender poles that supported its covering of leather were gathered together. It gilded the features of the Indians as with animated gestures they sat around it, telling their endless stories of war and hunting. It displayed rude garments of skins that hung around the lodge, the bow, quiver, and lance suspended over the resting place of the chief, and the rifles and powder horns of the two white guests. For a moment all would be bright as day. Then the flames would die away, and fitful flashes from the embers would illumine the lodge, and then leave it in darkness. Then all the light would wholly fade, and the lodge and all within it be involved again in obscurity. As I left the lodge next morning, I was saluted by howling and yelling from all around the village, and half its canine population rushed forth to the attack. Being as cowardly as they were clamorous, they kept jumping around me at the distance of a few yards, only one little cur about 10 inches long having spirit enough to make a direct assault. He dashed valiantly at the leather tassel, which in the Dakota fashion was trailing behind the heel of my moccasin, and kept his hold, growling and snarling all the while, though every step I made almost jerked him over on his back. As I knew that the eyes of the whole village were on the watch to see if I showed any sign of apprehension, I walked forward without looking to the right or left, surrounded wherever I went by this magic circle of dogs. When I came to Reynal's lodge, I sat down by it, on which the dogs dispersed growling to their respective quarters. Only one large white one remained, who kept running about before me and showing his teeth. I called him, but he only growled the more. I looked at him well. He was fat and sleek, just such a dog as I wanted. "My friend," thought I, "you shall pay for this. I will have you eaten this very morning." I intended that day to give the Indians a feast,
by way of conveying a favorable impression of my character and dignity, and a white dog is the dish which the customs of the Dakota prescribe for all occasions of formality and importance. I consulted Reynal. He soon discovered that an old woman in the next lodge was the owner of the white dog. I took a gaudy cotton handkerchief, and laying it on the ground, arranged some vermilion, beads, and other trinkets upon it. Then the old squaw was summoned. I pointed to the dog and to the handkerchief. She gave a scream of delight, snatched up the prize, and vanished with it into her lodge. For a few more trifles I engaged the services of two other squaws, each of whom took the white dog by one of his paws and led him away behind the lodges, while he kept looking up at them with a face of innocent surprise. Having killed him, they threw him into a fire to singe, then chopped him up and put him into two large kettles to boil. Meanwhile, I told Raymond to fry in buffalo fat what little flour we had left, and also to make a kettle of tea as an additional item of the repast. The Big Crow's squaw was set briskly at work sweeping out the lodge for the approaching festivity. I confided to my host himself the task of inviting the guests, thinking that I might thereby shift from my own shoulders the odium of fancied neglect and oversight. When feasting is in question, one hour of the day serves an Indian as well as another. My entertainment came off about 11 o'clock. At that hour, Reynal and Raymond walked across the area of the village to the admiration of the inhabitants, carrying the two kettles of dog meat slung on a pole between them. These they placed in the center of the lodge, and then went back for the bread and the tea. Meanwhile, I had put on a pair of brilliant moccasins, and substituted for my old buckskin frock a coat which I had brought with me in view of such public occasions. I also made careful use of the razor, an operation which no man will neglect who desires to gain the good opinion of Indians. Thus attired, I seated myself between Reynal and Raymond at the head of the lodge. Only a few minutes elapsed before all the guests had come in and were seated on the ground, wedged together in a close circle around the lodge. Each brought with him a wooden bowl to hold his share of the repast. When all were assembled, two of the officials called soldiers by the white men came forward with ladles made of the horn of the Rocky Mountain sheep, and began to distribute the feast, always assigning a double share to the old men and chiefs. The dog vanished with astonishing celerity, and each guest turned his dish bottom upward to show that all was gone. Then the bread was distributed in its turn, and finally the tea. As the soldiers poured it out into the same wooden bowls that had served for the substantial part of the meal, I thought it had a particularly curious and uninviting color. "Oh," said Reynal, "there was not tea enough, so I stirred some soot in the kettle to make it look strong." Fortunately, an Indian's palate is not very discriminating. The tea was well sweetened, and that was all they cared for. Now the former part of the entertainment being concluded, the time for speech-making was come. The Big Crow produced a flat piece of wood on which he cut up tobacco and shongsasha and mixed them in due proportions. The pipes were filled and passed from hand to hand around the company. Then I began my speech, each sentence being interpreted by Reynal as I went on, and echoed by the whole audience with the usual exclamations of assent and approval. As nearly as I can recollect, it was as follows. I had come, I told them, from a country so far distant that at the rate they travel, they could not reach it in a year.
How?
There the Meneaska were more numerous than the blades of grass on the prairie. The squaws were far more beautiful than any they had ever seen, and all the men were brave warriors.
How?
Here I was assailed by sharp twinges of conscience, for I fancied I could perceive a fragrance of perfumery in the air, and a vision rose before me of white kid gloves and silken mustaches, with the mild and gentle countenances of numerous fair-haired young men. But I recovered myself and began again. While I was living in the Meneaska lodges, I had heard of the Ogallala, how great and brave a nation they were, how they loved the whites, and how well they could hunt the buffalo and strike their enemies. I resolved to come and see if all that I heard was true.
How?
As I had come on horseback through the mountains, I had been able to bring them only a very few presents.
How?
But I had enough tobacco to give them all a small piece. they might smoke it and see how much better it was than the tobacco which they got from the traders.
How? How? How?
I had plenty of powder, lead, knives, and tobacco at Fort Laramie. These I was anxious to give them, and if any of them should come to the fort before I went away, I would make them handsome presents.
How? 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 How?
Raymond then cut up and distributed among them 2 or 3 pounds of tobacco, and old Menesila began to make a reply. It was quite long, but the following was the pith of it. He had always loved the whites. They were the wisest people on earth. He believed they could do everything, and he was always glad when any of them came to live in the Ogallala lodges. It was true I had not made them any presents, but the reason of it was plain. It was clear that I liked them, or I never should have come so far to find their village. Several other speeches of similar import followed, and then, this more serious matter being disposed of, there was an interval of smoking, laughing, and conversation. But old Menesila suddenly interrupted it with a loud voice. "Now is a good time," he said, "when all the old men and chiefs are here together to decide what the people shall do. We came over the mountain to make our lodges for next year. Our old ones are good for nothing. They are rotten and worn out. But we have been disappointed. We have killed buffalo bulls enough, but we have found no herds of cows, and the skins of bulls are too thick and heavy for our squaws to make lodges of. There must be plenty of cows about the Medicine Bow Mountain. We ought to go there. To be sure, it is farther westward than we have ever been before, and perhaps the snakes will attack us, for those hunting grounds belong to them. But we must have new lodges at any rate. Our old ones will not serve for another year. We ought not to be afraid of the snakes. Our warriors are brave, and they are all ready for war. Besides, we have 3 white men with their rifles to help us." I could not help thinking that the old man relied a little too much on the aid of allies, one of whom was a coward, another a blockhead, and the third an invalid. This speech produced a good deal of debate. As Raynal did not interpret what was said, I could only judge the meaning by the features and gestures of the speakers. At the end of it, however, the greater number seemed to have fallen in with Menesila's opinion. A short silence followed, and then the old man struck up a discordant chant, which I was told was a song of thanks for the entertainment I had given them. "Now," said he, "let us go and give the white men a chance to breathe." So the company all dispersed into the open air, and for some time the old chief was walking round the village, singing his song in praise of the feast, after the usual custom of the nation. At last the day drew to a close, and as the sun went down, the horses came trooping from the surrounding plains to be picketed before the dwellings of their respective masters. Soon, within the great circle of lodges, appeared another concentric circle of restless horses, and here and there fires were glowing and flickering amid the gloom of the dusky figures around them. I went over and sat by the lodge of Raynal. The Eagle Feather, who was a son of Menesila and brother of my host the Big Crow, was seated there already, and I asked him if the village would move in the morning. He shook his head and said that nobody could tell, for since old Mato Tatanka had died, the people had been like children that did not know their own minds. They were no better than a body without a head. So I, as well as the Indians themselves, fell asleep that night without knowing whether we should set out in the morning toward the country of the snakes. At daybreak, however, as I was coming up from the river after my morning's ablutions, I saw that a movement was contemplated. Some of the lodges were reduced to nothing but bare skeletons of poles. The leather covering of others was flapping in the wind as the squaws were pulling it off. One or two chiefs of note had resolved, it seemed, on moving. And so, having set their squaws at work, the example was tacitly followed by the rest of the village. One by one the lodges were sinking down in rapid succession, and where the great circle of the village had been only a moment before, nothing now remained but a ring of horses and Indians crowded in confusion together. The ruins of the lodges were spread over the ground, together with the kettles, stone mallets, great ladles of horn, buffalo robes, and cases of painted hide filled with dried meat. Squaws bustled about in their busy preparations, the old hags screaming to one another at the stretch of their leathern lungs. The shaggy horses were patiently standing, while the lodge poles were lashed to their sides and the baggage piled upon their backs. The dogs, with their tongues lolling out, lay lazily panting and waiting for the time of departure. Each warrior sat on the ground by the decaying embers of his fire, unmoved amid all the confusion, while he held in his hand the long trail rope of his horse. As their preparations were completed, each family moved off the ground. The crowd was rapidly melting away. I could see them crossing the river and passing in quick succession along the profile of the hill on the farther bank. When all were gone, I mounted and set out after them, followed by Raymond, and as we gained the summit, the whole village came in view at once, straggling away for a mile or more over the barren plains before us. Everywhere the iron points of lances were glittering. The sun never shone upon a more strange array. Here were the heavy-laden pack-horses, some wretched old women leading them, and two or three children clinging to their backs. Here were mules or ponies, covered from head to tail with gaudy trappings and mounted by some gay young squaw, grinning bashfulness and pleasure as the Meneaska looked at her. Boys with miniature bows and arrows were wandering over the plains, little naked children were running along on foot, and numberless dogs were scampering among the feet of the horses. The young braves, gaudy with paint and feathers, were riding in groups among the crowd, and often galloping, two or three at once along the line, to try the speed of their horses. Here and there you might see a rank of sturdy pedestrians stalking along in their white buffalo robes. These were the dignitaries of the village, the old men and warriors to whose age and experience that wandering democracy yielded a silent deference. With the rough prairie and the broken hills for its background, the restless scene was striking and picturesque beyond description. Days and weeks made me familiar with it, but never impaired its effect upon my fancy. As we moved on, the broken column grew yet more scattered and disorderly, until, as we approached the foot of a hill, I saw the old men before mentioned seating themselves in a line upon the ground, in advance of the whole. They lighted a pipe and sat smoking, laughing, and telling stories, while the people, stopping as they successively came up, were soon gathered in a crowd behind them. Then the old men rose, drew their buffalo robes over their shoulders, and strode on as before. Gaining the top of the hill, we found a very steep declivity before us. There was not a minute's pause. The whole descended in a mass amid dust and confusion. The horses braced their feet as they slid down. Women and children were screaming, dogs yelping as they were trodden upon, while stones and earth went rolling to the bottom. In a few moments I could see the village from the summit, spreading again far and wide over the plain below. At our encampment that afternoon, I was attacked anew by my old disorder. In half an hour, the strength that I had been gaining for a week past had vanished again, and I became like a man in a dream. But at sunset I lay down in the Big Crow's lodge and slept, totally unconscious till the morning. The first thing that awakened me was a hoarse flapping over my head, and a sudden light that poured in upon me. The camp was breaking up, and the squaws were moving the covering from the lodge. I arose and shook off my blanket with the feeling of perfect health, but scarcely had I gained my feet when a sense of my helpless condition was once more forced upon me, and I found myself scarcely able to stand. Raymond had brought up Pauline and the mule, and I stooped to raise my saddle from the ground. My strength was quite inadequate to the task. "You must saddle her," said I to Raymond, as I sat down again on a pile of buffalo robes. "Et hoc etiam fortasse meminisse juabit," I thought, while with a painful effort I raised myself into the saddle. Half an hour after, even the expectation that Virgil's line expressed seemed destined to disappointment. As we were passing over a great plain surrounded by long broken ridges, I rode slowly in advance of the Indians, with thoughts that wandered far from the time and from the place. Suddenly the sky darkened and thunder began to mutter. Clouds were rising over the hills, as dreary and dull as the first forebodings of an approaching calamity, and in a moment all around was wrapped in shadow. I looked behind. The Indians had stopped to prepare for the approaching storm, and the dark, dense mass of savages stretched far to the right and left.
Since the first attack of my disorder, the effects of rain upon me had usually been injurious in the extreme. I had no strength to spare, having at that moment scarcely enough to keep my seat on horseback. Then, for the first time, it pressed upon me as a strong probability that I might never leave those deserts. Well, thought I to myself, a prairie makes quick and sharp work. Better to die here in the saddle of the last than to stifle in the hot air of a sick chamber, and 1,000 times better than to drag out life, as many have done, in the helpless inaction of lingering disease. So, drawing the buffalo robe on which I sat over my head, I waited till the storm should come. It broke at last with a sudden burst of fury, and passing away as rapidly as it came, left the sky clear again. My reflections served me no other purpose than to look back upon as a piece of curious experience, for the rain did not produce the ill effects that I had expected. We encamped within an hour. Having no change of clothes, I contrived to borrow a curious kind of substitute from Reynal, and this done, I went home, that is, to the Big Crow's lodge, to make the entire transfer that was necessary. 6 squaws were in the lodge, and one of them, taking my arm, held it against her own, while a general laugh and scream of admiration were raised at the contrast in the color of the skin. Our encampment that afternoon was not far distant from a spur of the Black Hills, whose ridges, bristling with fir trees, rose from the plains 1 mile or 2 on our right. That they might move more rapidly toward their proposed hunting grounds, the Indians determined to leave at this place their stock of dried meat and other superfluous articles. Some left even their lodges, and contented themselves with carrying a few hides to make a shelter from the sun and rain. Half the inhabitants set out in the afternoon with loaded pack horses toward the mountains. Here they suspended the dried meat upon trees, where the wolves and grizzly bears could not get at it. All returned at evening. Some of the young men declared that they had heard the reports of guns among the mountains to the eastward, and many surmises were thrown out as to the origin of these sounds. For my part, I was in hopes that Shaw and Henry Chatillon were coming to join us. I would have welcomed them cordially, for I had no other companions than 2 brutish white men and 500 savages. I little suspected that at that very moment my unlucky comrade was lying on a buffalo robe at Fort Laramie, fevered with ivy poison and solacing his woes with tobacco and Shakespeare. As we moved over the plains on the next morning, several young men were riding about the country as scouts, and at length we began to see them occasionally on the tops of the hills, shaking their robes as a signal that they saw buffalo. Soon after, some bulls came in sight. Horsemen darted away in pursuit, and we could see from the distance that 1 or 2 of the buffalo were killed. Raymond suddenly became inspired. I looked at him as he rode by my side. His face had actually grown intelligent. "This is the country for me," he said. "If I could only carry the buffalo that are killed here every month down to St. Louis, I'd make my fortune in 1 winter. I'd grow as rich as old Papin or Mackenzie either. I call this the poor man's market. When I'm hungry, I have only got to take my rifle and go out and get better meat than the rich folks down below can get with all their money. You won't catch me living in St. Louis another winter." "No," said Reynal. "You had better say that after you and your Spanish woman almost starved to death there. What a fool you were ever to take her to the settlements." "Your Spanish woman?" said I. "I never heard of her before. Are you married to her?" "No," answered Raymond, again looking intelligent. "The priests don't marry their women, and why should I marry mine?" This honorable mention of the Mexican clergy introduced the subject of religion, and I found that my 2 associates, in common with other white men in the country, were as indifferent to their future welfare as men whose lives are in constant peril are apt to be. Raymond had never heard of the Pope. A certain bishop who lived at Taos or Santa Fe embodied his loftiest idea of an ecclesiastical dignitary. Reynal observed that a priest had been at Fort Laramie 2 years ago, on his way to the Nez Perce mission, and that he had confessed all the men there and given them absolution. "I got a good clearing out myself that time," said Reynal, "and I reckon that will do for me till I go down to the settlements again." Here he interrupted himself with an oath and exclaimed, "Look, look, the panther is running an antelope." The panther, on his black and white horse, one of the best in the village, came at full speed over the hill in hot pursuit of an antelope that darted away like lightning before him. The attempt was made in mere sport and bravado, for very few are the horses that can for a moment compete in swiftness with this little animal. The antelope ran down the hill toward the main body of the Indians, who were moving over the plain below. Sharp yells were given, and horsemen galloped out to intercept his flight. At this he turned sharply to the left, and scoured away with such incredible speed that he distanced all his pursuers and even the vaunted horse of the panther himself. A few moments after, we witnessed a more serious sport. A shaggy buffalo bull bounded out from a neighboring hollow, and close behind him came a slender Indian boy, riding without stirrups or saddle, and lashing his eager little horse to full speed. Yard after yard he drew closer to his gigantic victim, though the bull, with his short tail erect and his tongue lolling out a foot from his foaming jaws, was straining his unwieldy strength to the utmost. A moment more and the boy was close alongside of him. It was our friend the Hailstorm. He dropped the rein on his horse's neck and jerked an arrow like lightning from the quiver at his shoulder. "I tell you," said Reynal, "that in a year's time that boy will match the best hunter in the village. There he has given it to him, and there goes another. You feel well now, old bull, don't you, with two arrows stuck in your lights? There he has given him another. Hear how the Hailstorm yells when he shoots. Yes, jump at him. Try it again, old fellow. You may jump all day before you get your horns into that pony." The bull sprang again and again at his assailant, but the horse kept dodging with wonderful celerity. At length the bull followed up his attack with a furious rush, and the Hailstorm was put to flight, the shaggy monster following close behind. The boy clung in his seat like a leech, and secure in the speed of his little pony, looked round toward us and laughed. In a moment he was again alongside of the bull, who was now driven to complete desperation. His eyeballs glared through his tangled mane, and the blood flew from his mouth and nostrils. Thus still battling with each other, the two enemies disappeared over the hill. Many of the Indians rode at full gallop toward the spot. We followed at a more moderate pace, and soon saw the bull lying dead on the side of the hill. The Indians were gathered around him, and several knives were already at work. These little instruments were plied with such wonderful address that the twisted sinews were cut apart, the ponderous bones fell asunder as if by magic, and in a moment the vast carcass was reduced to a heap of bloody ruins. The surrounding group of savages offered no very attractive spectacle to a civilized eye. Some were cracking the huge thigh bones and devouring the marrow within. Others were cutting away pieces of the liver and other approved morsels, and swallowing them on the spot with the appetite of wolves. The faces of most of them, besmeared with blood from ear to ear, looked grim and horrible enough. My friend the White Shield proffered me a marrow bone, so skillfully laid open that all the rich substance within was exposed to view at once. Another Indian held out a large piece of the delicate lining of the paunch, but these courteous offerings I begged leave to decline. I noticed one little boy who was very busy with his knife about the jaws and throat of the buffalo, from which he extracted some morsel of peculiar delicacy. It is but fair to say that only certain parts of the animal are considered eligible in these extempore banquets. The Indians would look with abhorrence on anyone who should partake indiscriminately of the newly killed carcass. We encamped that night and marched westward through the greater part of the following day. On the next morning we again resumed our journey. It was the 17th of July, unless my notebook misleads me. At noon we stopped by some pools of rainwater, and in the afternoon again set forward. This double movement was contrary to the usual practice of the Indians, but all were very anxious to reach the hunting ground, kill the necessary number of buffalo, and retreat as soon as possible from the dangerous neighborhood. I pass by for the present some curious incidents that occurred during these marches and encampments. Late in the afternoon of the last mentioned day, we came upon the banks of a little sandy stream, of which the Indians could not tell the name, for they were very ill acquainted with that part of the country. So parched and arid were the prairies around that they could not supply grass enough for the horses to feed upon, and we were compelled to move farther and farther up the stream in search of ground for encampment. The country was much wilder than before. The plains were gashed with ravines and broken into hollows and steep declivities which flanked our course,
As in long scattered array, the Indians advanced up the side of the stream. Mene Sila consulted an extraordinary oracle to instruct him where the buffalo were to be found. When he with the other chiefs sat down on the grass to smoke and converse, as they often did during the march, the old man picked up one of those enormous black and green crickets which the Dakota call by a name that signifies "they who point out the buffalo." The root diggers, a wretched tribe beyond the mountains, turn them to good account by making them into a sort of soup, pronounced by certain unscrupulous trappers to be extremely rich. Holding the bloated insect respectfully between his fingers and thumb, the old Indian looked attentively at him and inquired, "Tell me, my father, where must we go tomorrow to find the buffalo?" The cricket twisted about his long horns in evident embarrassment. At last he pointed, or seemed to point them, westward. Mene Sila, dropping him gently on the grass, laughed with great glee, and said that if we went that way in the morning we should be sure to kill plenty of game. Toward evening we came upon a fresh green meadow traversed by the stream and deep set among tall sterile bluffs. The Indians descended its steep bank, and as I was at the rear, I was one of the last to reach this point. Lances were glittering, feathers fluttering, and the water below me was crowded with men and horses passing through, while the meadow beyond was swarming with the restless crowd of Indians. The sun was just setting, and poured its softened light upon them through an opening in the hills. I remarked to Reynal that at last we had found a good camping ground. "Oh, it is very good," replied he ironically, "especially if there is a snake war party about, and they take it into their heads to shoot down at us from the top of these hills. It is no plan of mine camping in such a hole as this." The Indians also seemed apprehensive. High up on the top of the tallest bluff, conspicuous in the bright evening sunlight, sat a naked warrior on horseback, looking around, as it seemed, over the neighboring country, and Raymond told me that many of the young men had gone out in different directions as scouts. The shadows had reached to the very summit of the bluffs before the lodges were erected and the village reduced again to quiet and order. A cry was suddenly raised, and men, women, and children came running out with animated faces and looked eagerly through the opening on the hills by which the stream entered from the westward. I could discern afar off some dark, heavy masses passing over the sides of a low hill. They disappeared, and then others followed. These were bands of buffalo cows. The hunting ground was reached at last, and everything promised well for the morrow's sport. Being fatigued and exhausted, I went and lay down in Kongra Tonga's lodge, when Raymond thrust in his head and called upon me to come and see some sport. A number of Indians were gathered, laughing, along the line of lodges on the western side of the village, and at some distance I could plainly see in the twilight two huge black monsters stalking, heavily and solemnly, directly toward us. They were buffalo bulls. The wind blew from them to the village, and such was their blindness and stupidity that they were advancing upon the enemy without the least consciousness of his presence. Raymond told me that two men had hidden themselves with guns in a ravine about 20 yards in front of us. The two bulls walked slowly on, heavily swinging from side to side in their peculiar gait of stupid dignity. They approached within 4 or 5 rods of the ravine where the Indians lay in ambush. Here at last they seemed conscious that something was wrong, for they both stopped and stood perfectly still, without looking either to the right or to the left. Nothing of them was to be seen but two huge black masses of shaggy mane, with horns, eyes, and nose in the center, and a pair of hoofs visible at the bottom. At last the more intelligent of them seemed to have concluded that it was time to retire. Very slowly, and with an air of the gravest and most majestic deliberation, he began to turn round, as if he were revolving on a pivot. Little by little his ugly brown side was exposed to view. A white smoke sprang out, as it were, from the ground. A sharp report came with it. The old bull gave a very undignified jump and galloped off. At this his comrade wheeled about with considerable expedition. The other Indian shot at him from the ravine, and then both the bulls were running away at full speed, while half the juvenile population of the village raised a yell and ran after them. The first bull was soon stopped, and while the crowd stood looking at him at a respectable distance, he reeled and rolled over on his side.
The other, wounded in a less vital part, galloped away to the hills and escaped. In half an hour it was totally dark. I lay down to sleep, and ill as I was, there was something very animating in the prospect of the general hunt that was to take place on the morrow. End of chapter 14.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Stephen at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Stephen.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.